It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if new revenue projections hold up, Wisconsin is going to have a budget surplus approaching $3 billion. We'll take a look at what Governor Evers and state Republicans want to do with the extra money. First, in 2018, former President Donald Trump signed a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill into law. It was known as the First Step Act. It was designed to reduce recidivism and long prison sentences. Fast forward to now, and thousands of people in federal prison are slated to be released early under that law. But a tool being used by the Justice Department to help figure out who gets released early may be leading to some biased results. We're taking a closer look at that story and talking about the role of technology in the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support reforms to reduce the length of prison sentences for some offenders and to lower the overall prison population? And then how do we decide who can be released early and who can't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Carrie Johnson is a national justice correspondent for NPR. Carrie, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, happy to be there. Thank you.
Can you remind us of the basics on the First Step Act? What was it? What did it set out to do?
Yeah, lawmakers from both political parties came together to overwhelmingly pass this law. The first thing it did was to lessen the penalties, lessen the sentences for certain kinds of drug crimes, and give judges more discretion. And the second thing it did was basically create an algorithm to assess the risk of people already in prison and to give people who were low and minimum risk the chance to take programs inside prisons that would help them reenter society. And if they took those programs, they'd get credits and be able to get out early. And my reporting found that there were fundamental flaws with that last system, with that risk assessment tool, that it was plagued by human error and math errors and even racial disparities.
Can you talk about this algorithm being used by the Justice Department? It's called Pattern. What do we know about what goes into Pattern to assess this kind of risk?
Yeah, there's been three versions of Pattern. It's been plagued by problems all along. Analysts say it's gotten a little bit better, a little bit more accurate in terms of avoiding some of those kind of bungled human errors and math errors. But even so, in this new version of Pattern, 14,000 people inside federal prisons were still misassessed and will need to be reassessed. They were put into the wrong risk categories. Among the factors that go into this, inputs that go into this tool, are things like criminal history and other factors that people say could be racially biased, in part because, as we know, police sometimes have a greater presence and conduct more arrests in Black and brown communities than they do in white communities. And so some of the inputs in this system were already kind of suspect, according to analysts. And as a result, it's producing some racial disparities where it's over-predicting the risk that some Black, Hispanic, and Asian people in prison would return to crime or break new rules if they left prison. And that's a problem.
Carrie, if I'm in federal prison and this algorithm says, yeah, Rob is low risk, what does that mean for me? What kind of systems do I get into that can lead me ultimately out of prison?
Yeah, Rob, this means that you would be able to get credit for working a job inside prison, building furniture or doing some other kind of work, that you would get credit toward early release for taking a drug rehabilitation program, for taking life skills classes, for taking college-level classes online as a kind of correspondent student. All of those things would build up into your account and would allow you to get out of prison early. The problem is that these risk categories are a little bit all over the place, and there are also some racial disparities leading some Black and brown inmates to not be eligible in the first place, because only people who are low in minimal risk are allowed to participate in this programming and get credit to get out early.
Talking to Carrie Johnson, national justice correspondent for NPR, looking at a change in federal law. This happened a few years back. It gives a pathway for some federal prison inmates to get out of prison, but concerns, as we're hearing, that the algorithms, the systems used to say whether one person is too high a risk to participate in this, to get out, maybe flawed. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, I think whenever we're using an algorithm, the hope is that This is going to somehow be an unbiased and impartial alternative to letting a person, a parole officer or a parole board or whatever it might be, make these decisions with their own individual biases. Are people giving up hope for that now?
They're not exactly giving up hope, but they're pointing out that these risk tools like Pattern, these algorithms, are dependent on the people who create them and what they decide is important and what counts. And so the goal of people like Melissa Hamilton, a professor, a law professor at the University of Surrey, who I consulted for my piece, is to reduce the disparities to an extent that it seems to be more fair to use this algorithm than to have people with all kinds of unconscious bias make these decisions.
Now, outside groups are pointing to this, and as you mentioned, some law professors and others. Is the Justice Department saying, yeah, even with this third version of Pattern, we still need to make changes?
Yes, they are. Attorney General Merrick Garland has directed a team at the Justice Department to try to reduce these disparities, fix some of these issues, make this tool more transparent for people who want to conduct independent research, all with an eye toward developing a new and better version of this tool. It's going to take a while. And remember, 14,000 people inside federal prison were put into the wrong category. So the Bureau of Prisons has to reassess all those people in prison once they come up with a new tool.
And when you say put into the wrong category, is it always somebody who should have been low risk was said high risk so they can't get out? Or does it go the opposite direction sometimes, too?
Yeah, that's what's so confounding about these problems. They go both ways. In some cases, the tool overpredicts the risk of a return to crime. In other cases, it underpredicts. And that is really confounding for researchers. They've got to wrap their arms around this, in part because people's liberty, people's freedom is tied to this tool. So it has important real-life consequences for thousands and thousands of folks.
Now, this was passed again back in 2018. Are we at a stage now, Carrie, where people are actually walking out the prison door now?
Actually, last month in January, people started to leave prison early because of these credits and the way the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons were allocating them. At this point, we think several thousand people have left over the last few weeks. The problem or the challenge is that some of those decisions may have been affected by the biases in this tool. So it's not at all clear to lawyers who defend some of these folks and advocates who watch all of these issues from a civil rights perspective, that this was really a fair process.
Now, this is a federal program involving federal prisons. As I understand it, Carrie, most inmates in prison in this country are in state prisons. Are people at the state level, as far as you know, looking at this as a possible model or else cautionary example for their own systems?
In fact, members of Congress at the federal level got some of these ideas from advancements in the states. Some of these ideas have already been put into place in states. And in the criminal justice system across many states, their use of risk assessment and other algorithms. The problem is this is the first time the federal government has tried to do this and tie it to people's liberty, the ability to leave prison early. And they didn't do such a good job. They're trying, but it still doesn't seem quite right.
What are you watching for next as the Justice Department continues to, I guess, tweak this system?
I think that there are some people out there, including the ACLU, the Sentencing Project, and the federal public defenders, who believe the Justice Department should just pause the use of this tool, that there's really no way to fix some of these fundamental flaws, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on senior Justice Department officials to pause or scrap this Pattern algorithm altogether in the months and years ahead.
If the algorithm is scrapped, does that kill the whole First Step Act then, effectively?
No, the reforms that were intended to lighten the prison sentences for people convicted of new crimes like drug-related crimes and nonviolent offenses like that would continue as part of the First Step Act. And importantly, the First Step Act allowed people in prison who are really in dire circumstances in terms of being sick to petition courts directly for compassionate release. That program has allowed at least 300 people in prison to leave during the pandemic, and that would continue too.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carrie Johnson, National Justice Correspondent for NPR. She was with us today to talk about racial biases in a Justice Department tool meant to determine eligibility for early release for federal prisoners. Up next, we'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about how risk assessments work and hear about the upsides and downsides of risk assessment technology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the use of risk prediction technology, these algorithms we've just been hearing about in the criminal justice system, determining who might be eligible to get out of prison earlier? Do algorithms and data have a place in determining who gets released early from prison or who has to stay in jail before a trial? If you've encountered these systems, the criminal justice system, as a defendant, inmate, parolee, or you work in the system, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about the role of risk assessment in the criminal justice system and why new technology used for risk assessment can lead to biased results. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences on one side or the other of these issues. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Caldwell joins us now. He's a senior lecturer in psychology and part of the Center for Law, Society, and Justice at UW-Madison. He's also a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison, where he's provided risk assessments. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You do clinical risk assessments in your work. Can you tell us how that differs from these algorithm risk assessments we were just hearing about?
Well, a clinical risk assessment is based on the clinician's experience and their understanding of the current research. So it's not as mechanical as the algorithms that are used. The person has to be very up to date on the current research, and also their methodology has to be guided by what's known from the research.
What kind of things are part of the latest research when it comes to evaluating whether someone, if they're released from an institutional setting, a correctional setting, is going to put other people at risk?
Well, that's a complicated question because no two people are exactly alike. A lot of people who have alcohol or drug problems are higher risk, for example. But, of course, somebody who is into a good recovery program and is working that well may not be. And age plays a big role in people's tendency to do antisocial behavior and criminal behavior. And then there's just all kinds of things around what kind of a setting is the person going back to? Do they have family support that's going to help them or hurt them? Are they in a situation where they can get a job and housing and all those kinds of things? So it's a pretty complicated set of factors that come together.
How much concern is there that racial bias can creep into, first of all, these kinds of in-person clinical assessments?
There should be quite a bit of concern on the clinical end and also on when it comes to these algorithms as well. One of the things, of course, you look at is the person's behavior pattern over time. But as we know, different jurisdictions enforce laws in different ways, we want that. We have local prosecutors elected, and they have different, slightly different ways they handle certain cases. So you have to be somewhat familiar with all of that and kind of take that into consideration as you go. But we also know, of course, that all of the information you're relying on, whether it's research in a clinical assessment or whether it's a actuarial or algorithm type of risk assessment, it's all based on information from a number of years ago, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. That's when you originally code the information. That's the foundation for the assessment. And we know that there's been a number of biases built into the system, kind of woven into the system, without even being, at times without it being deliberate. So if you take a model and it's a pretty accurate description of how things worked, say, 20 years ago, and you apply it today, it's going to work the way it did 20 years ago. And if you want to do things better than we did 20 years ago, you're going to have to vary from that model in some ways. And it's not always 100% clear what's the best way to vary from that model.
Do you see it as possible that we can come up with some sort of algorithm system, whatever that might look like, that does help filter out some of the bias? Or are we doomed to, I don't know, garbage in, garbage out in that kind of system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it's possible to mitigate some of the bias built into these systems, but I think more often you're in a situation where you have to apply these structured risk assessments in something other than a mechanistic way. You have to recognize that there's some bias built into them, and things have changed over time. And also, one of the other characteristics of these algorithms is that it's much easier to code static variables in a person's history. It's much easier to collect information on how many times they've been arrested or what kinds of crimes they've been arrested for than it is to quantify personal change. How much has the person changed since they were last arrested? That's a tough one to nail down because people change in different ways. And so these scales tend to be very insensitive to personal change. They tend to give you about the same risk today that they would have given you if you had scored them, 10 years ago. They have to be, if they're going to be used and not do more harm than good, they have to be used in something other than a mechanistic way where the number, you get a certain number and that directly results in a certain outcome.
We're talking to Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. We're talking about risk assessment to determine if people can leave a correctional facility, a jail or prison, how these things work. And this, as we're hearing, the flaws that can sometimes end up even in algorithms that we hope will be impartial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Anna in West Bend who couldn't stay on the line. Anna says her child's father was convicted for child molestation, sentenced to 30 years, was released 10 years early because of an algorithm and the pandemic. And Anna says it caused great trouble, concern for the families associated with him. Does that come up in these evaluations, the impact on past victims and maybe their concerns for the future for someone going through this kind of evaluation?
I don't know of any of the algorithms that specifically capture that. There's an indirect way that they may capture how serious the crime was that the person did, how much harm the victim experienced, in the sense that they may give more weight to, for example, violent crimes against the number of violent crimes against a person and less weight to fewer violent crimes, but nothing direct that I'm aware of in most of these algorithms. And again, a hard thing to capture how much harm the victim has experienced.
It seems like this goes way back in criminology and prison systems, the idea that we can come up with a scientific system that's going to help make our decisions for us when, as you say, every story is unique, every person in the system is unique. Is this a circle we're never going to be able to square?
Well, I think we've gotten a little ways down the road. We're doing better than we did, say, 50 years ago. I don't think these algorithms and the actuarial measures that we're using are completely useless, but I do think they have to be well understood by the people that are using them, and especially the limitations that they present. As I mentioned, the change and the strength that the person brings to the situation, and actually, as the caller said, the potential harm, all those things need to be considered along with whatever the mechanistic score shows you.
One thing I wanted to ask about is transparency of these systems. Some of these risk assessment technology tools and algorithms are coming from private companies who don't always let everyone know, I guess, what goes into the process. How important is it to you that there's transparency? We know what goes into these decisions.
Yeah, that's transparency of privately developed scales is a serious problem. And I think the people that develop the scales would agree with that. They would say that the way that they developed the scale is proprietary information, just the same way that Google or Amazon might say that the way that their algorithms work is also private proprietary information. But what that means is that you can't have an independent check on how well that works, and especially you can't have an independent check on how should it apply to this particular individual. Is this person all of these risk assessment scales worked on the assumption that the person that you're evaluating pretty much matches the group that you use to develop the scale. And of course, there are exceptions to that. People who don't actually match, who have an unusual mental disorder or some other kind of unique characteristic that wasn't well represented in the original sample. So it's very difficult to pull that out or to examine that in these so-called black box scores.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison and a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. He's with us today to talk about how risk assessments are used in the criminal justice system and the kinds of bias and transparency concerns there are in risk assessment technology, algorithms that are used at the state and federal levels.